Absolutely no question about it. You are listening to The Swing Era. I'm your host, Bud Pearson, and I would welcome any comments or requests. Just email us. Our address is swingera@earthlink.net. That's swingera@earthlink.net. Back to the swing era, the year is 1944, and here's Gene, Dodo, and Buddy. Thank you. You heard it on the Swing Era, the clarinet of Buddy DeFranco, featured with the Gene Krupa V-Disc Trio. They performed Ellington's Hodgepodge from May 1944. All three participants were working with Tommy Dorsey at the time. The piano was Dodo Marmarosa and, of course, Gene's drums. And to begin the second half of the Swing Era, the Krupa DeFranco Marmarosa Trio again from the same May 1944 session with a lively Liza, the clarinet of Buddy DeFranco, and you heard it on the Swing Era.
Tommy Dorsey and the Sentimentalists in I Never Knew.
Love. love anybody, baby, like I'm loving you.
Buddy DeFranco and his clarinet just up, again with Tommy Dorsey, and Kern's The Song Is You, a Victor recording from April 1946, featuring some smooth Dorsey trombone, Charlie Shaver's trumpet, and Buddy playing a nearly perfect eight bars. And before that, the Clark Sisters, also known as the Sentimentalists, sang with T.D., I Never Knew, from a V-disc broadcast of April 1944, with DeFranco's clarinet, Al Klink's tenor, and I believe Pete Condoli's brief trumpet. And at the top, Gene Krupa's drums kicking it off, sounding almost like Buddy Rich with Cy Oliver's Well, Get It, featuring more blazing Buddy DeFranco clarinet, along with T.D. and the tenor of Al Klink. The trumpets, I would guess, were Pete Condoli and Joe Somebody, on the swing era, celebrating the clarinet artistry of Buddy DeFranco. on the Swing Era, a Metronome All-Star session from December 1947 with a tune titled Leap Here, featuring the winners of the annual Metronome Magazine poll of jazz musicians. And as usual, Buddy DeFranco won the clarinet category. Featured alongside Buddy was the piano of Nat Cole, Bill Harris's trombone, Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet, Flip Phillips' tenor, Eddie Safransky's bass, and the guitar of Billy Bauer, and a subdued Buddy Rich on drums. And in the middle, Buddy with an August 1949 group with Penthouse Serenade. And starting the last set, another Metronome All-Stars recording, this one from January 1946 with the 45 winners, again with Buddy like a breath of fresh air on clarinet, with the tune titled Look Out, composition of Cy Oliver. Both critics and musicians agree that Buddy was the first artist to bring modern jazz to the clarinet, with great range, technique, tone, fire, and imagination. And, as you heard today, he could swing. And there you have it, clarinet genius Buddy DeFranco on the Swing Era. That's it. Hope you enjoyed master musician Buddy DeFranco today. So many recordings and so little time to play them. But we'll trek back to the record vault for more discs. Till then, this is your host, Bud Pearson, inviting you to join us here next week when we'll present more artists who created the styles and the sounds of the swing era. We'll see you then. And remember, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Sunny Tennessee, you love her when you see sweet Jenny Lee. Each little bird is singing merrily, just getting set to see sweet Jenny Lee. She's got that certain something in her style. She's got a bit of heaven in her smile. She promised me that she'd say yes, sirree. That's good enough for me, sweet Jenny Lee. Thank you.
Atherton, Redwood City, a broadcast service of the Sequoia Union High School District.
Our imagination, a comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite shows. Radio, oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us?
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear, a look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Time once again to settle into your favorite easy chair for another hour of classic radio entertainment. On this edition of Yesteryear, it's a program calculated to keep you in suspense. But first, Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater of the Air. The Mercury Theater came to CBS in July of 1938 following a smash season on stage. Ultimately, it would make Orson Welles' name a household word before the first year was up. Welles, at the age of 22, was already a radio veteran when the Mercury Theater on the Air was formed. By 1935, he'd become almost a regular on The March of Time, and then since 1937 was heard weekly as Lamont Cranston in The Shadow for Goodrich Tires. The Mercury Theater and Welles ultimately got their biggest splash of publicity with Welles' broadcast of The War of the Worlds. In 1946, the Mercury Players were heard in the summer season for Pabst Blue Ribbon, broadcasting half-hour classics from June until September of that year. Return with us now to those fabulous days of yesteryear with Orson Welles starring in The Hitchhiker, first broadcast on June 2nd of 1946.
Major Bowes, I miss the shadow nose, Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern, Helen Trent, oh, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Merton Marr, Jameis, and Andy.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles, your producer of a special series of broadcasts, the Mercury Summer Theater of the Air. Ladies and gentlemen, the element of suspense is so vital to our story tonight that our sponsors, the makers of Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, are omitting their usual commercial message during the intermission between the acts, so that our play will go uninterrupted from spooky start to spooky finish. We of the Mercury reckon that a story doesn't have to appeal to the heart, it can also appeal to the spine. Sometimes you want your heart to be warm, sometimes you want your spine to tingle. Well, the tingling, it's to be hoped, will be quite audible as you listen tonight to a classic among radio thrillers. Its author is one of the most gifted of all the writers who've ever worked for this medium, Lucille Fletcher, who wrote the greatest single radio script ever written. Sorry, wrong number. The title of this, her terrifying little tale of Gru for this evening, is another spine tingler by name, The Hitchhiker. I am in an auto camp on Route 66, just west of Gallup, New Mexico. If I tell it, maybe it'll help me. It'll keep me from going crazy. But I must tell this quickly. I'm not crazy now. I feel perfectly well. Perfectly well. except that I'm running a slight temperature. My name is Ronald Adams. I'm 36 years of age, unmarried, tall, dark, with a black mustache. I drive a 1940 Ford V8, license number 6B7989. I was born in Brooklyn. All this I know. I know that I'm at this moment perfectly sane, that it is not me who's gone mad, but something else, something utterly beyond my control. But I must speak quickly. Any moment, the link with life may break. This may be the last thing I ever tell on Earth. The last night I ever see the stars. Six days ago, I left Brooklyn to drive to California.
Goodbye, son. Good luck to you, my boy.
Goodbye, Mother. Here, give me a kiss, and then I'll go.
I'll come out with you to the car.
Ah, it's raining. Stay here at the door.
Oh.
Hey, what's this, tears?
Oh, it's just the trip, Ronald. I wish you weren't driving.
Oh, Mother, there you go again. People do it every day.
I know, but you'll be careful, won't you? Promise me you'll be extra careful. Don't fall asleep or drive fast or pick up any strangers on the road.
Strangers? Don't you worry. There isn't anything going to happen. It's just 8 days of perfectly simple driving on smooth, decent, civilized roads with a hot dog or a hamburger stand every 10 miles. I was in excellent spirits. Drive ahead. Even the loneliness seemed like a lark. But I reckoned without him. Crossing Brooklyn Bridge that morning in the rain, I saw a man leaning against the cables. He seemed to be waiting for a lift. There were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. He was carrying a cheap overnight bag in one hand. He was thin, nondescript, with a cap pulled down over his eyes. He stepped off the walk, and if I hadn't swerved, I'd have hit him. I almost did. Almost did hit him. Now, I would have forgotten him completely, except that just an hour later, while crossing the Pulaski Skyway over the Jersey Flats, I saw him again. At least he looked like the same person. He was standing now with one thumb pointing west. I couldn't figure out how he'd got there, but I thought maybe one of those fast trucks had picked him up, beat me to the Skyway, and let him off. I didn't stop for him. Then, late that night, I saw him again. It was on the new Pennsylvania Turnpike between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. It's 265 miles long with a very high speed limit. I was just slowing down for one of the tunnels when I saw him standing under an arc light by the side of the road. I could see him quite distinctly. The bag, the cap, even the spots of fresh rain spattered over his shoulders. He hailed me this time.
Hello!
Stepped on the gas like a shot. It's lonely country through the Alleghenies, and I had no intention of stopping. Besides, the coincidences, or whatever it was, gave me the willies. I stopped at the next gas station.
Yes, sir. Fill her up, will you? Take your oil?
No, thanks.
Nice night, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it hasn't been raining here lately, has it?
Not a drop of rain all week.
Oh, no? I suppose that hasn't done your business any harm.
Well, people drive through here all kinds of weather. Mostly business, though. Ain't many pleasure cars out in the turnpike this season of the year.
I guess not. What about hitchhikers?
Hitchhikers here?
Why, what's the matter? Don't you ever see any?
A guy'd be a fool to start out to hitchhike on this road. Look at it.
Then you never see anybody?
No. Maybe they get a lift before the turnpike starts. I mean, you know, just before the toll house. But then it's a mighty long ride. Most cars wouldn't pick up a guy for that long a ride. This is pretty lonesome country here, mountains and woods.
Yeah.
Hey, you ain't seen nobody like that, have you?
Oh, no. It's just a technical question.
Oh, I see. Well, that'll be $1.49 with the tax.
Thing gradually passed from my mind as coincidence. I had a good night's sleep in Pittsburgh. I didn't think about the man all next day until
just outside of Zanesville, Ohio, I saw him again. It was a bright, sunshiny afternoon. The peaceful Ohio fields, brown with the autumn stubble, lay dreaming in the golden light. I was driving slowly, drinking it in, when the road suddenly ended in a detour. In front of the barrier, he was standing. Let me explain about his appearance before I go on. I repeat, there was nothing sinister about him. He was as drab as a mud fence, nor was his attitude menacing. He merely stood there, waiting, almost drooping a little, the cheap overnight bag in his hand. He looked as though he'd been waiting there for hours. And he hailed me. He started to walk forward.
Hello! Hello!
I had stopped the car, of course, for the detour. For a few minutes, I couldn't seem to find the new road. I realized he must be thinking that I'd stopped for him.
Hello!
No, oh, I'm... Not just now, I'm sorry.
Going to California?
No, not today. The other way, I'm going to New York. Sorry. After I got the car back onto the road again, I felt like a fool. Yet the thought of picking him up, of having him sit beside me, was somehow unbearable. Yet at the same time, I felt more than ever unspeakably alone. Hour after hour went by. The fields, the towns ticked off one by one. The lights changed. I knew now that I was going to see him again. And though I dreaded the sight, I caught myself searching the side of the road, waiting for him to appear.
Yep. What is it? What's wrong?
You sell sandwiches and pop here, don't you?
Yep, we do. In the daytime, they close up for the night.
I know, but I was wondering if you could possibly may have a cup of coffee. Black coffee.
Not at this time of night, mister. My wife's a cook and she's in bed.
Well, now, listen, just a minute ago, there was a man standing here, right beside here, and he was a suspicious-looking man.
Henry! Who is it, Henry?
It's nobody, Mother. She's a fella thinks she wants a cup of coffee. Go back into bed.
I don't mean to disturb you, but you see, I was driving along when I just happened to look, and there he was.
What was he doing?
Nothing.
You've been hitting the bottle. That's what's the matter with you. You got nothing better to do than wake decent folk out of their hard-earned sleep? Now get going, go on.
But he looked as though he was going to rob you.
I ain't got nothing in this stand to lose. Now on your way before I call out Sheriff Polk.
I got into the car again and drove on slowly. I was beginning to hate the car. If I could have found a place to stop to rest a little, but in the Ozark Mountains of Missouri now, few resort places there were closed. I had seen him at that roadside stand. I knew I'd see him again. Maybe at the next turn of the road. I knew that when I saw him next, I'd run him down. But I didn't see him again until late the next afternoon. I'd stopped the car at a sleepy little junction just across the border into Oklahoma, let a train pass by when he appeared across the tracks. He was leaning against a telephone pole. It was a perfectly airless, dry day. The red clay of Oklahoma was baking under the southwestern sun. Yet there were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. I couldn't stand that. Without thinking, blindly, I started the car across the tracks. He didn't even look up at me. He was staring at the ground. I stepped on the gas hard, veering the wheel sharply toward him. I could hear the train in the distance now, but I didn't care. Then,
Something went wrong with the car. It stalled right on the tracks. The train was coming closer. I could hear its bell. Her cry, its whistle crying. Still, he stood there. Now I knew that he was beckoning. Beckoning me to my death.
Frustrated him that time. The starter had worked at last. I managed to back up, but after the train had passed, he was gone. I was all alone in the hot, dry afternoon. After that, I knew I had to do something. I didn't know who this man was or what he wanted of me. I only knew that from now on, I mustn't let myself be alone on the road for 1 minute.
Hello there. Hello. Like a ride?
What do you think? How far are you going?
Amarillo. I'll take you to Amarillo.
Amarillo, Texas?
Yeah, I'll drive you there.
Gee.
Pop here.
Mind if I take off my shoes? My dog.
No, go right ahead.
Oh, gee, what a break this is. Swell car and decent guy driving all the way to Amarillo. All I've been getting so far is trucks.
You hitchhike much?
Sure. Only it's tough sometimes in these great open spaces to get the break.
Yeah, I think it would be, but I'll bet, though, if you got a good pickup and a fast car, you'd get to places faster than, well, say, another person in another car.
I don't get you.
Well, you take me, for instance. Suppose I'm driving across the country at a nice, steady clip of about 45 miles an hour. Couldn't a girl like you just standing beside the road, waiting for lifts, beat me to town after town, provided she got picked up every time in a car that was doing 65 or 70 miles an hour?
I don't know. Maybe she could, maybe she couldn't. What difference does it make?
Oh, no difference. It's just crazy idea I had sitting here in the car.
Oh, imagine spending your time in a swell car thinking of things like that.
What would you do instead?
What would I do if I was a good-looking fellow like yourself? I'd just enjoy myself. Every minute of the time, I'd sit back and relax. If I saw a good-looking girl along the side of the road... Hey!
Did you see him, too?
Who?
That man standing beside the barbed wire fence.
I didn't see anybody.
Right there.
There was nothing, just a barbed wire fence. What did you think he was doing, trying to run into that barbed wire fence?
There was a man there, I tell you. A thin, gray man with an overnight bag in his hand. I was trying to run him down.
Run him down? You mean kill him?
I'm trying to get rid of him. Or at least prove that he's real. But you say you didn't see him back there. You sure?
I didn't see a soul. As far as that concerns...
Well, watch for him the next time, and keep watching. Keep your eyes peeled on the road. He'll turn up again. Maybe any minute now. There! Look there!
How'd this door work? I'm getting out of here.
Did you see him that time? Did you see him?
No, I didn't see him that time. And personally, mister, I don't expect never to see him. All I want to do is go on living. And I don't see how I will very long driving
with
you.
I'm sorry. I don't know. What came over me? Please, don't go.
Oh, if you'll excuse
me,
please,
you can't go. Listen, how'd you like to go to California? I'll drive you all the way to California.
Pink elephants all the way? No, thanks.
Listen, please, just 1 minute.
You know what I think you need, big boy? Not a girlfriend, just a good dose of sleep. There, I cut it now.
No. No, you can't go.
Leave your hands off of me here. Leave your hands.
Come back here, please. Come back. She ran from me. As if I was some kind of monster. A few minutes later, I saw a passing truck pick her up. I knew then that I was utterly alone. I was in the heart of the great Texas prairies. There wasn't a car on the road after the truck went by. Trying to figure out what to do, how to get a hold of myself.
going to find a place to rest, or even if I could sleep right here in the car. A few hours. And sleep. Just along the side of the road. I was getting my winter overcoat out of the back seat to use as a blanket. Just as a blanket. When I saw him coming toward me. Coming toward me. Emerging from the herd of moving steer. I didn't wait for him to come any closer. Maybe I should have spoken to him then. Fought it out then and there, for now he began to be everywhere. Whenever I stopped, even for a minute, for gas, for oil, for a drink, a pop, a cup of coffee, a sandwich, he was there. I saw him standing outside the auto camp in Amarillo that night when I dared to slow down. He was standing near the drinking fountain, a little camping spot just inside the border of New Mexico. He was waiting for me outside the Navajo reservation where I stopped to check my tires. I saw him in Albuquerque where I bought 10 gallons of gas. I was afraid now. Afraid to stop. I began to drive faster and faster. I was in lunar landscape now. The great arid mesa country of New Mexico. I drove through it with the indifference of a fly crawling over the face of the moon. And now he didn't even wait for me to stop. Plus, I drove at 85 miles an hour over those endless roads. He waited for me at every other mile. I'd see his figure. Shadowless. Flitting before me, still in its same attitude, over the cold and lifeless ground, flitting over dried up rivers, over broken stones cast up by old glacial upheavals, flitting in the pure and cloudless air. Myself when I finally reached Gallup, New Mexico this morning. There's an auto camp here. It's cold. Almost deserted this time of year. I went inside and asked if there was a telephone. I had the feeling that if I could speak to somebody familiar, somebody that I loved, I could pull myself together.
Number, please.
Long distance.
Thank you. This is long distance.
I'd like to put in a call to my home to Brooklyn, New York. I'm Ronald Adams. The number is Beechwood 9970.
Thank you. Thank you. What is your number?
My number? It's 312.
Albuquerque. New York for Gallup. New York. Gallup, New Mexico, calling a Beechwood 9970.
I'd read somewhere that love could banish demons. It was in the middle of the morning. I knew Mother'd be home. I pictured her tall, white head in her crisp house dress going about her tasks. It'd be enough, I thought, just to hear the even calmness of her voice.
Will you please deposit $3.85 for the first 3 minutes? When you have deposited $1.50, will you wait until I have collected the money? All right. Deposit another $1.50. deposit the remaining 85 cents. Ready with Brooklyn. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
This is Adams' residence.
Hello. Hello, Mother?
This is Mrs. Adams' residence. Who is it you wish to speak to?
What? Who is this?
This is Mrs. Whitney.
Mrs. Whitney? I don't know any Mrs. Whitney. Is this Beechwood 9970?
Yes.
Where's my mother? Where's Mrs. Adams?
Mrs. Adams is not at home. She's still in the hospital.
The hospital?
Yes. Who is this calling, please? Is it a member of the family?
What's she in the hospital for?
She's been prostrated for 5 days. A nervous breakdown.
Nervous.
Who is this calling?
Nervous breakdown. My mother's never...
It's all taken place since the death of her oldest son, Ronald.
Since the death of her oldest son, Ronald? Hey, what is this? What number is this?
This is Beechwood 9970. It's all been very sudden. He was killed just 6 days ago in an automobile accident on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Sir, your 3 minutes are up.
And so, I'm sitting here in this deserted auto camp in Gallup, New Mexico. And so I'm trying to think. I'm trying to get a hold of myself. Otherwise I'll go crazy. Outside, it is night. The vast, soulless night of New Mexico. A million stars are in the sky. Ahead of me stretch 1,000 miles of empty mesa, mountains, prairies, desert. Somewhere among them, he is waiting for me. Somewhere I shall know who he is and who I am.
Now here is Orson Welles. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, we bring to your radio another Mercury favorite. We hope a favorite of yours. You've asked for it many times. We've performed it many times. Jane Eyre. And Jane will be played by a Mercury actress who was heard tonight and has been heard so often on our shows. One of the most gifted people we know in our business, Miss Alice Frost. Jane Eyre, then, with Alice Frost and your obedient servant. That's the same time next week, same station. Please join us. Until then, speaking for my sponsors, for all of us on the Mercury Theater, including Bernard Herrmann, who wrote and conducted the music on this program, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
From June 2nd of 1946, it's been the Mercury Theater of the Air with The Hitchhiker, starring Orson Welles. In a moment, The Beast Must Die with guest star Herbert Marshall, a program calculated to keep you in suspense as this edition of Yesteryear continues.
KCEA.
Hello again, I'm David Miller, host of Swingin' Down the Lane. Our weekly program has been running on KCEA for a good long time, and I hope for years to come. That's why I'm glad to pitch in and pitch for your participation in this year's pledge drive. Last year's totals were the best ever, and there's no reason that listeners can't outdo themselves this month. And there's a new challenge, too, because the costs of running the station are going up. Streaming fees are higher than last year. Copyright fees are up. To top it off, the station is obliged to purchase new equipment to meet the mandate from the FCC to revamp the emergency alert system, the system that gives you instant warning when an emergency arises. So I join with others in asking that you dig down deep this month to support KCEA. And don't forget to tune in each week to Swinging Down the Lane. Please send your tax-deductible contribution to KCEA Membership, 555 Middlefield Road, Atherton, California, 94027. Or you can donate online at kcea.org. Once there, click on the Our Music page and then the Donate button. It's that simple. Again, KCEA Membership, 555 Middlefield Road, Atherton, California, 94027. Or online at kcea.org. Once there, click on the Our Music page and then the Donate button.
This is Don Kennedy, host of Big Band Jump, heard Saturdays at 6 p.m., reminding you to also listen to Spotlight on the 30s and 40s with Craig Roberts, Monday from 7 to 9 p.m., here on KCEA, the home of the Big Bands, 89.1.
The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear. Here's Craig Roberts.
Suspense, radio's outstanding theater of thrills, was first broadcast on CBS in June of 1942. It continued then on the air for the next 20 years under many talented directors, each bringing his own mark to suspense, making it one of the most diverse, unusually broad-based programs of radio. Suspense dealt with life-or-death situations. That element was usually established within the first few moments. Then, through characterization and great sound effects, touches were added here and there to heighten the sensation of impending doom. In fact, that's what suspense was all about. The slow tightening of the knots. Suspense opened to the ringing of soft church bells intermingled with stinging music. By the fall of its first year, Joseph Kearns, the grim-voiced fellow known as the Man in Black, was aboard as narrator. The Man in Black had disappeared by the time the program went to 60 minutes in 1948. In 1949, it made the transition to television, but never fared as well as it had on radio. The final curtain on Suspense rang down in 1956. Return with us now to those fabulous days of yesteryear with Suspense, guest starring Herbert Marshall in The Beast Must Die, another classic radio moment from the archives of yesteryear.
Roma Wines present Suspense. Roma Wines, made in California for enjoyment throughout the world.
Salute.
Your health, senor.
Roma Wines toast the world. The wine for your table is Roma Wine, made in California for enjoyment throughout the world.
The Roma Wine Company of Fresno, California, welcomes you again to this weekly half hour of suspense. Tonight from Hollywood, Roma Wines bring you a star, Mr. Herbert Marshall. Mr. Marshall is with us to play in Nicholas Blake's powerful story of vengeance and retribution, The Beast Must Die. And with the performance of Herbert Marshall as Felix Lane, who wrote A Diary of Death, we again hope to keep you in suspense.
Kill a man. I don't know his name. I don't know where he lives. I have no idea what he looks like. But I'm going to find him and kill him.
Well, Mr. Lane?
I wrote those words, if that's what you're asking, Inspector. And I meant them.
Apparently you did. Whatever possessed you to write such a document?
Vanity, for one thing, I suppose. A record for posterity of the perfect crime. As you know, I'm a writer by profession. I think more clearly on paper. By keeping this diary, I was able to plan my murder step by step. detail, little things that happened in the course of a day which might so easily have been forgotten or overlooked, were written down in this diary, where I could refer back to them and make use of them if need be.
But you found out that a real-life murder could not be carried out so easily as the murders you wrote about in your detective novels, eh, Mr. Lane?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, Inspector. In fact, except for the ending, I think this diary is quite the best murder story I've ever written.
Yeah, and quite the most incriminating document I've ever known a prospective murderer to leave lying around.
Incriminating? In a way, I suppose. In another way, this diary might turn out to be my best defense.
How do you figure that, Mr.
Lane? Supposing I read some parts of it aloud to you and let you decide for yourself.
Very well, Mr. Lane. Fire away.
That was my first entry. June 18th. Yes, I'm going to kill a man. It takes great singleness of purpose to commit a murder. But if ever for a moment I stray from that purpose, I've only to think of Ronnie. Ronnie was my son. One evening, 2 weeks ago, he was crossing the road outside our house. He had gone into the village to buy some candy. For him, it could have been only a paralyzing blaze of headlights around the corner, a moment's nightmare, and then the impact turning everything to darkness forever. His body was hurled into the ditch. He was dead at once. The motorist who killed Ronnie did not stop. The police have failed to trace him. They say he must have been going 50 around that blind corner from a child's body to have been thrown and injured as it was. The man who drove that car, he is the man I have got to find and kill. June 25th. I found my first clue today. My mind was on Ronnie. I was driving toward a neighboring town. The hills around were green. The boxwood hedges, still damp from last night's rain, translucent like giant chunks of emerald. Suddenly, the front wheels of my car hit into a great puddle. A sheet of water splashed up over the front of the windshield and drenched me from the side. I pulled up at the far side of the water splash. I got out, cursing myself for my preoccupation, and began mopping away at the windshield. A man leaning over a farm gate addressed me.
Whoa! Looks like you got a proper shower bath, mister.
Yes.
They've pestered the county for months to repair that hole. People always driving into it, splashing themselves all over. Funny thing of all, though, was about a fortnight ago when a chap tried to use it to get a free car wash.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was my wife's birthday, to be exact. About 8 o'clock, we was on our way to Cheltenham to see the picture show. Just coming out of the gate, this chap driving one of those low-slung sports jobs hits the water splash.
You don't say?
Yeah. And then the fella says something to the girl he's driving with. What do you suppose they do? They back up and run through the splash again. And then again. They did it 4 times.
8 o'clock. Your wife's birthday, it wouldn't be June 3rd, would it?
Oh, right, yeah. But how'd you know?
Well, you see, a friend of mine was celebrating that night. He was driving toward
Severnbury. That's where this fella and his lady friend were going. I remember his lady friend says, George, ask the man whether you turn to the right or to the left at the next fork.
George. George, yes, that's right. That's my pal's name. And, Severnbridge, yes. Yes. The way he drives ought to have brought him here by just around 8 o'clock. He didn't have a crumpled right front fender, did he?
Oh, that he did. And that bloke was your friend. He sure is a proper nut. Well, peculiar, at least.
Yes. Yes, he is peculiar.
Driving through that water splash all over again and again. 4 times he does it. He wasn't laughing either. Didn't seem like a joke somehow. Looks like he's trying to get a free car wash. Funny way, I'd say, to get the mud off.
Yes.
Maybe it was tar, though. Huh?
Yes. Or blood. July 12th. At Severnbridge, I've talked to any number of the town's people, and I've met a number of Georges. But not one of them have owned or driven a low-slung sports job. Not like the one I've been looking for, anyway. It may be that I have to start all over again on some other tack. I was returning to the inn this afternoon when I noticed the car parked on the side of the road up ahead. The girl with bright hair was working the rear wheel, and a small lad beside her was doing his best to help. I pulled up beside them. It was a long, low, slung sport job. I say, can I help?
Well, what do you think, Phil?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, if you would lend a hand. I'm afraid we're not quite heavy enough to weight the jack handle down for another turn.
Now, here, fella, let me have a go at it. I say, the paint doesn't seem quite to match on the right front fender.
The fender? Oh, that had a new fender put on a while back. It got bunged up or something.
I can't tell you how awfully nice it is of you to help us out.
Not at all. By the way, I wonder if you and Phil here wouldn't stop for tea with me at the inn afterwards. It's not far, you know.
We're expected at home, sir. Perhaps you could come along with us. What do you do, sir?
Why, I'm a writer, Phil.
Oh, you really must come to see us. It's Gables on Devon Road, my brother-in-law's place. The name's Rattery. We'll give you a ring tomorrow and set a date. Sis will love meeting a real author, and so will George.
Did you say your brother-in-law's name is George? July 16th. I've met him. I've spent an evening talking to him. George Rattery.
So you're a friend of Lena's, eh? Storybook detective. A writer. Easy enough to write about a dead body. Well, I'd like to see an author that guts enough to look at one.
I had been more than a little afraid that George might turn out to be a sympathetic character. That need not concern me any longer. I shall have no compunction at all about putting his light out. It appears that George is the half-owner of a garage down in town. A man by the name of Carfax is the other partner. A garage. That would explain how the damaged fender got itself fixed without the police knowing. Ah, oh, how can a beast like George have a fine young son like Phil? This afternoon, I was rounding the corner of the tea house in the Rattery's garden when I heard voices. It was Lena and George. I stopped in my tracks and eavesdropped shamelessly.
It's a neat rig you're wearing today, Lena. Is that for Felix Lane's benefit?
Save your compliments for that Carfax woman.
Jealous.
Don't make me laugh. But someday you're going to find out that business partner of yours isn't as mild as he looks. I wonder what he'd say if he knew that his wife was...
Shut up, will you? And since when did you get so high and mighty? It wasn't so long ago that you yourself were glad enough to...
If you ever open your mouth about any of that, I swear I'll kill you.
Talking big now, aren't we, Miss Snow White?
Just try something and you'll find out. Remember, there are quite a few people who might like to know about that poor kid you ran down last June. If it weren't for Violet and Phil, I'd...
Stop that kind of talk. You hear? Just remember you were with me that night.
August 5th. Had a look around the Rattery Carfax garage this afternoon. Told George it might come in useful as material in my book. All at once I heard a shot, and there stood George blazing away over the plot in back with a rifle. I went up to him.
There. That's another one of the pests out of the way. We've tried everything. Traps, poisons, rat hunts. We can't keep them down.
That's a nice rifle.
Yeah. Gave it to Phil when he came back from school in Switzerland. Much too good for him. Here, I'd like to have a go at him.
I raised the rifle and sighted. George's back was to me. By shifting a few inches to the right, the bullet should enter the base of the brain. Who could prove that George hadn't suddenly stepped in my way? My finger tightened on the trigger.
I say, George, I can't find that new tin of rat poison. Still spreading some out in the dump yesterday. I wonder where he put it.
Oh, hello there, Lane.
Hello, Carfax. Hey, watch out where you're pointing that gun. We wouldn't want anything to happen to the senior partner, eh?
Not very funny. I am now a guest in the house of the man I am going to kill. Violet, Phil's mother, suggested that I come and stay with him for a fortnight and help Phil in odd hours with his Latin. George, much to our surprise, joined in heartily with the idea. I wonder why. I must watch him very closely because of what happened last night. We were having coffee in the drawing room after dinner when the conversation took a most extraordinary turn. They were talking about Violet's new rose bushes.
I suppose they'll be very nice, but I can't for the life of me see why you went to all that trouble.
Well, the old ones weren't doing very well.
They were still alive, weren't they, Mother?
Oh, yes, dear, but I'm not one to keep something going when it's only half alive.
Oh, I'm glad you're talking about rose bushes. I should hate to think you felt that way about people.
Of course not. But, on the other hand, I do think if a person were incurably ill that they ought to... Well, that is, they ought to have the right to ask their doctor to put them out of their misery. Don't you think so, Felix? Speaking of doctors, reminds me, George, don't forget your tonic. Doctor said after every meal.
Tonic. Pass it here. Foul stuff, bitter as gall, poison. That won't kill you, George.
Felix, would you really be in favor of doing away with all unfortunates?
What about your incurable social pest, the person who makes life miserable for everyone else around him? I think a person would be justified in killing someone like that.
I do think you're all getting a little morbid.
The kind of a person I describe has no right to life. Of course, that's to say I would if I could do it without running my neck into a noose. Now, in my book, I'm working on a very pretty murder. Quite my masterpiece, I think.
Well, he's darn close about it. Locked doors, sealed lips and all that. Of course, he says he's writing a thriller, but we've no proof, have we? I think you ought to show us the manuscript, Felix. Don't you, Lena?
I can't. I'm sorry. I hate anyone to see an unfinished manuscript of mine. I'm funny that way.
Oh, Felix, please, get it and read some of it. Come on, don't be a spoilsport.
I'll go and get it myself and read it out loud if the blushing author is too coy. By heaven, I'll go upstairs and fetch it now.
You do not hear the sword. I'll admit it. I will not have people snooping about among my manuscripts. I was close. After all, there is no book but this diary. I must keep it well hidden in my room. At last, I have my plan. It took a great deal of subtle taunting and persuasion, but it came off at last. George is going sailing with me this afternoon, and he can't swim. Drowning is very painful, they say, in the early stages. That's good, I'm glad. George's lungs bursting, the top of his head shrieking with pain, his hands scrabbling vainly to thrust against the giant weight of the water. But if I cannot kill George today on the open sea, with the wind in my favor and myself the undisputed master of the situation, if I fail today, then I will know that it is not my destiny to be a murderer, and I will make no further attempt on the life of George Rattray. And that, Inspector Blunt, is the last entry in my diary.
You and George did go sailing, didn't you?
Yes, it was after lunch on the same day. We walked down to the docks together. George, as you can imagine, was rather clumsy about a boat, but it was only a few minutes after he clambered aboard that we were out in the main water, sailing free. George had his feet braced against the centerboard case and his hands gripped the gunwale. The squall was coming up.
It's getting pretty close, isn't it?
There'll be plenty of room, George. Our vessels have to give way to sailing vessels, you know.
Give way? Huh. How do you think a boat that size is going to give way to a crate like this? Hey there, what are you up to? Look out, I tell you. You can't. What if you run into us? I'll probably want to hang on to your leg and we're both drowned. What are you doing? What?
A bit close, but perfectly safe.
Oh, perfectly safe. That barge didn't miss us by a yard.
The same thing happened the other day when I was out with Phil. He didn't lose his nerve.
Oh, he didn't, eh?
By the way, you better not stand up in the boat again. That's one thing that's not safe.
Very well, my friend. But I shouldn't try any of those funny tricks you've been planning.
Tricks? What tricks?
You know what I mean, you filthy sneak. I searched your room just before lunch, and I found your diary. I posted that precious diary of yours up to my solicitor just before I came out here. Posted it, mind you, just before we went sailing.
For you see, it'll be most unfortunate for you if you let me drown.
Well, what's the matter? Lost your lying tongue, have you? I ought to break your jaw for you. I've a good mind to hand over your diary to the police.
Don't be silly. You know perfectly well you won't do anything of the kind. And for the very good reason that you don't want the police to haul you in on a charge of manslaughter for killing my son.
You can't prove I ran over your son.
Aren't you forgetting that Lena was with you that night? The police will get a confession out of her in no time.
Why, you... You, if ever I see you again after today, you slug, I'll bash you into a jelly.
Shut up, George. I guess we've both been a little too clever. It looks like a stalemate. I docked the boat and George stormed off the minute we landed. I came straight here to the inn.
Yes, I know.
Perhaps it's just as well I didn't succeed. Going back to writing detective stories after committing the perfect crime would be like going back to playing with tin soldiers after winning the Battle of Waterloo.
You seem to be awfully sure of your alibi.
Well, after all, there's no crime in planning a murder, is there? Providing nobody's hurt?
Unfortunately, somebody has been hurt.
What do you mean? What are you trying to tell me?
George Rattray died yesterday evening of the effects of strychnine poisoning.
George dead. Strychnine poisoning. All my planning, all my high and tragic purpose, and the beast ends by taking his own life. Poison. I remember now, he used to talk about suicide quite a lot. But I thought he only did it because the subject was so upsetting to his wife. I never dreamed. How did he take it?
With his tonic. But it couldn't possibly have been suicide, Mr. Lane.
But who? What else could it have been?
It could have been murder. Unfortunately, we have no evidence except this diary of yours.
Oh, the bottle, the tonic.
George Rattray died almost instantly after taking his tonic at dinner. But before the doctor arrived, that bottle disappeared.
Well, any suspects?
Every person closely associated with George Rattray had enough motive to murder him. But you have the strongest motive. After all, George Rattray did kill your son.
Am I under arrest?
Not officially as yet. But naturally, I've posted a guard outside your room. In the meantime...
But Hansel can't go in there. He told
him. Don't let me by. I tell you, I've got to see Inspector Blunt. Please, Mother. I say it's no good.
Be quiet, Phil. Why couldn't you have stayed at home?
Officer, let me by. I must see.
Now, let them come in, officer. Good afternoon, Mrs. Rattray. Phil.
Hello, Phil.
Hello, Felix. Please. Please, I can't stand it any longer. They're accusing Felix here of murdering my husband. He had nothing
Mother
to do with it.
Said. She doesn't know what she's saying.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Phil, will you be quiet? It was I who killed George. He treated me very badly. He was unspeakable to Phil. There was another woman. Oh, I can't go on.
Are you trying to tell me, Mrs. Rattray, that you gave your husband poison?
Yes.
Mother!
I tell you, I poisoned him.
Where did you get the poison, Mrs. Rattray?
I bought it at that chemist shop.
What chemist shop?
The one on Abbey Lane, near the corner of High Towers, that's it.
Uh-huh. Well, what became of the bottle of tonic after your husband's death?
I broke it. I buried it.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Rattray. The police have checked. You didn't buy any poison at the chemist's.
Mother, I told you it was no good. Sir, Mother is trying to save me. It was I, sir. I killed him.
What? Phil, you don't.
Don't believe him. Don't believe him. He's just a foolish child. He doesn't know what he's saying.
Go on, Phil.
Well, you see, sir, I left the note. I was running away, but Mother found the note before I quite got out the door.
Oh, boys get such strange ideas. He couldn't have done it. He's just a boy. You know he couldn't.
You see, sir, when they accused Felix here, I couldn't stand it any longer. That's why I wrote you the note that Mother found at first. She said if she confessed that they wouldn't do much to her, if the police would understand. Felix made them believe me. I can prove I did it.
Now, go on, Phil. You say you can prove it. What do you mean?
I have it here in my pocket, sir. I've had it hit ever since. See, here it is. It's still half full. It's that bottle of tonic.
Phil.
Phil, where did you get that?
I took it off the buffet after the doctor said Dad was dead.
But this is very serious, Phil. You know that.
He's lying. He couldn't have. He's just a little boy.
Please, all of you, I have a favor to ask. Let me talk to Phil alone for a few minutes. won't hurt anything. I think I may be able to help solve this whole thing. Phil didn't do it. Violet's right.
Yes, but the bottle...
Just give Phil and me 10 minutes alone.
Very well. We'll wait outside.
10 minutes, mind you, Phil. No more.
Come here, Phil.
I'm a murderer, Felix.
You are not a murderer, Phil. No one could ever tell me that.
I left the note.
We've gone all over that.
I killed him. He beat Mother. I killed him, I told
Stop
you.
Stop that, Phil. I know better.
They thought you did it, Felix. I heard them talking about your diary. You wanted to kill him. You said so in your diary.
Maybe I did, but...
They'd hang you, Felix.
So that's why you wrote the note and pretended you did it?
Yes, I saw you in the pantry with Dad's bottle of tonic before you went for the sale with him.
You saw me? Oh, I'm sorry, Phil. Sorry you saw me. Naturally, you jumped to the conclusion that I... Oh, poor little man. Well, there's nothing for you to worry about now, Phil.
You mean they're not going to hang you, Felix?
They're not going to hang me.
You won't let them do anything to you? Promise me.
No, I won't let them do anything to me. But, Phil, there are other things for you to think about now. Now that your father's gone, you are head of the house. That's a man's job, Phil. There's a lot you've learned about courage these last few days. Living takes a lot of courage. This is pretty grown-up talk, Phil. Do you understand me?
I'm trying, Felix.
You remind me a lot of my own son.
You mean the boy my father ran?
That's right, Phil. Yes, you're a lot like him.
Would he have gone sailing with us?
Oh, yes. I think Ronnie would have been quite a sailor.
Can we go sailing tomorrow, Felix?
Not tomorrow, Phil.
Are you going away, Felix?
Yes, but not as far as most people might think.
You sound very strange, Felix.
I have a note to write. I have to make everything shipshape. You go on out to your mother and tell them they may join me in a few minutes.
Can't I wait, Felix?
No, Phil. Go ahead now.
But you...
Those are orders. Skipper's orders.
Aye, aye, sir.
Goodbye, son. I thought I'd made the last entry in this diary, but there will have to be one more. This diary was kept for only one purpose, to make George and the police believe that I planned to kill the beast by drowning him. Death was already waiting for George Rattray at home, in the bottle of his tonic, where I have traced 3 pellets of rat poison taken by me from the garage. My plan was almost perfect. The only thing I didn't expect was that someone loved me enough to try to destroy the evidence I had so carefully planted in an effort to help me. And even to confess to my crime in order to save my skin. I know now that my life ended with the death of my son, Ronnie. It seems that I must have just come back to life for a few weeks to save Phil. Yes, I killed George Rattray. I have no regrets. I might have known that the matter would be taken care of fittingly. It says in the Bible, the beast must die, but the man dieth also. Yea, they both must die. George was right about that tonic of his. It is very bitter.
And so closes The Beast Must Die, starring Herbert Marshall. Tonight's tale of Suspense. Suspense is produced and directed by William Spear. Mr. Marshall appeared through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of White Cliffs of Dover. Next Thursday, same time, you will hear Mr. Peter Lorre with Richard Conte as stars of Suspense. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
From July 13th of 1944, it's been Herbert Marshall starring in Suspense and The Beast Must Die. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Yesteryear, but join us again next week at the same time and invite a friend to listen. Together, enjoy more great moments from the golden age of radio. I'm Craig Roberts with those fabulous days of yesteryear. Till next time, so long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. The comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite shows. Radio, I miss you, sodio, vodio, dodio, do. Radio, I miss you so.
preceding program copyright Edgewater Productions. All rights reserved.
KCEA Atherton, Redwood City. Online at kcea.org. The home of the big bands.
So let's
again. You'll never get the gate if your swinging is up to date. When your one and only complains that she's lonely and blue. A rhythmical campaign can do more than champagne to see her through. Swing high, swing low, swing to and fro. Not fast, not slow. And if you think you can swing high, swing low.
Future Focus, a weekly public affairs program powered by the students of Sequoia Union High School District. Sunday mornings at 8 Pacific on Big Band 89.1 KCEA. Online at kcea.org.
Send your love and your kisses to guide me. each night. In every prayer, if you call, I'll hear you. No matter how far, just close your eyes and I'll be there. Please walk alone and send your love and your kisses to guide me. Till you're walking beside me, I'll walk alone. I'll walk alone.
This is Fred Hall. I call my show Swing Thing, and it's by and about the big bands, but much more. We dig the Dixie file. We find great records that are rare but well done. We answer your request, and we talk with a great and near great from among the top leaders, singers, sidemen, composers, and arrangers. Join me for all that's great and that thing called Swing. Swing Thing.
Thursdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on Big Band 89.1 KCEA.
We've stood and talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. Smile, you were smiling then, but I can't remember where or when. Some things that happened for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have met before, and we've loved before, and loved before. But who knows where or when?
She gave her attention. Not to him, not to her, not to them, not to those, but to me. Her family, they held a convention. Not for him, not for her, not for them, not for those, but for me. I'm delighted, yes, sir, and I have to laugh. Standing on my dresser is a photograph which proves that she gives all her attention. Not to him, not to her, not to them, not to those, but to me. Not for him, not for her, not for them, not for those, but for me.